Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1231, we present an incredible new story from new writer Frankie Diaz. On tonight's show, we feature an excerpt from The Taste of Water, a novel, a richly layered book written by new writer Frankie Diaz. Tonight's excerpt, like the book itself, weaves history, folklore, humor, and irreverence into a magical tale. Frankie Diaz grew up in a small village near Mangalore, India. At the age of 21, he moved to Mumbai and worked as a bank officer, later posted to Goa for 5 years. He wrote and produced a musical, then moved to Dubai, where he worked in international banking and wrote a column for the local newspaper. He is fluent in Konkani, Kannada, Tulu, Hindi, and English. In 1990, he and his wife, along with their daughter and son, then 3 and 6 years old, moved to Toronto, Canada. Frankie Diaz spends his time composing music and writing and lives between Canada, India, and the south of France. In the excerpt that we feature tonight, you will meet 6 of the multitude of characters who people the Taste of Water. The Alvarez sisters, devout spinster twins, who eventually decide that they've offered enough masses, sacraments, prayers, novenas, and sodalities to accumulate more than enough grace for their eternal lives and venture into carnal threesome relationships with a younger fellow villager and later with a man of the cloth. Silent Salvador, their mute brother, who peppers the novel with 4-line written verses that prove to be foretelling aphorisms. Ducor Dorju, called Ducor because his pork was without doubt the best to be had in all the 10 surrounding villages and towns due to his accidental discovery that the secret of exquisite taste lay in having pigs die happy, laughing to their last breath. The main character Victor and his friend Shambu, who both go on from the scene we see tonight to share a lifetime of struggles with ambition and success, love and lust, power and impotence, and sin and redemption. Let's listen now to Spectral Sword Fight, the Alvarez Spinsters, Ducor Dorju, and Silent Salvador, an excerpt from The Taste of Water, a novel, written by Frankie Diaz. Read for tonight's program by John Dunford.
A Spectral Sword Fight, the Alvarez Spinsters, Ducor Dorju, and Silent Salvador. An excerpt from The Taste of Water by Frankie Diaz. Read by John Dunford. Rama Rao announced that the historical play, The Sword of Tipu Sultan, would be performed by his students, and the auditions would take place before the Christmas holiday break. There was no shortage of tales about Tipu Sultan. He was a major figure in the repertoire of the Upal Valley Gumet players. In the scale of tragic events, the suppression of Mangalorean Christians during the rule of Tipu Sultan in the late 18th century ranked second only to the brutal oppression of their forefathers in the menacing days of the Goan Inquisition. The Upal Valley Gumet players vividly described scenes of the march to Sri Rangapatnanam, the abduction of Mangalorean women, their defilement by Tipu Sultan's soldiers and generals, and the persecution of the families who resisted their orders. For his audition, Victor sang the melancholic song of the Upal Valley Gumet players to demonstrate his knowledge of the subject. He was chosen to play Tipu Sultan. Shambu was given the role of Colonel Bailey. Whenever he placed himself in the shoes of Tipu Sultan, Victor wished for a horse more than anything in the world. He knew that Tipu was an amazing rider, and his magnificent stallion had leaped over high walls and across enemy lines as if it had wings. But as far as Victor knew, such a horse, or for that matter any horse, was not available within 100 miles of Upal, and even if he became an accomplished rider and found a stallion like Tipu Sultan's, The stage in the school was unlikely to accommodate such a gallant horse. So Victor's visions of racing through hills, kadak, 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 and flying over walls lived in his imagination only. Yet he and Shambu, after much pleading and negotiating over safety and promises of prudent handling, did manage to obtain 2 swords from Ramareo. That was some consolation. Victor was deeply committed to bringing the legendary Tipu Sultan to life. Shambu was determined to demonstrate that the British, who came in as traitors and remained as rulers of India for 3 centuries, were not without guts and valor. After rehearsal, Victor and Shambu walked home in the moonlit night dressed as Tipu Sultan and Colonel Bailey. Victor wore a fake beard, an ornate kurta, a jeweled waistband, and all the finery of a great warrior king. Shambu was dashing in a British colonel's uniform with stars and gold stripes on a scarlet tunic. The boys were on their way to fulfill their promise to put on a private show of the legendary sword fight, undoubtedly the most important part of the play, for the benefit of Zhao Manuel, who was unable to climb the hill and walk the 3 miles to watch the performance. On their way, in a meadow, past a clump of trees, at the top of a hill, Victor and Champu decided to practice their sword fighting in the glow of the bright moonlight. They drew their swords and began to fight, and the action gave them a wonderful feeling. Many hundreds of years ago, real wars must have been fought exactly this way. They battled with deep concentration, lost to the world, the cool wind at their ears, swords shining, and the sparks flying. Meanwhile, the Alvear spinsters negotiated a bend on a nearby dirt road, walked through the clump of trees in the meadow, and were suddenly presented with a spectacle. 2 figures from ancient history were locked in a fierce sword fight less than 200 yards away. The spinsters froze in their tracks. It was too late to turn back because the strange figures had seen them and had stopped their sword fight. The Alvear sisters, only in their early 20s, despite their spinster status, were late returning from a visit to the city after their bus had broken down. They had no doubt they were looking at the ghosts of ancient warriors. They did some quick thinking and remembered that the only way for a woman to chase ghosts away was to shame them. The spinsters undressed in a matter of seconds, both of them naked. They bundled their clothes, hoisted the bundles high in the air, and like 2 wild mares, clomped resolutely towards the ghosts. Lo and behold, the ghosts took flight. They leaped over a hedge and disappeared. The Alvear spinsters briskly marched along, their defiant breasts bouncing and their furious pelts flashing danger signals to all the hapless ghosts in the vicinity. Victor and Shambu watched, wide-eyed, from behind the hedge until they passed by. Then the boys stood up and gawked, knowing full well that the sisters, knowledgeable in the rules relating to encounters with ghosts, would not turn their heads and look back under any circumstance. They watched in the moonlight until the sisters disappeared over the curve of the hill in the distance. Carmen and Simona Vares volunteered at the church and ensured that the boys and girls behaved properly in the house of God. They were stricter with females because girls chit-chatted and laughed all the time. The 2 sisters remained unmarried because of the stigma of madness that ran in their family, a smirch caused by their brother, Silent Salvador. His affliction was entirely harmless to others. However, it had the unfortunate result of his healthy, well-endowed sisters remaining unmarried virgins. No one in their right mind would have wedded either of them, for, as everyone knew, insanity runs in families, and it was only a matter of time before the spinsters would go mad. As if the stigma was not enough, there was also the problem of the gruesome murder. One sunny day, when the Alvear sisters and Silent Salvador were young children, Ducor Dorju, their father, arrived home from the market with the biggest, fattest, most rebellious shebto ever caught in the Mulki River. With its enormous power, the fish had almost broken the cast net and the fisherman had to dive deep, without regard for his own life, to subdue the monster. He ran 8 miles non-stop to the market with the huge shebto, which throbbed with energy and burst with life. When he saw the angry fish, gasping to hold on to its life, Ducor d'Arjou knew he had to buy the Chèvetot. He was also one of the few people in the market that day who could afford to pay for such a magnificent fish. Although his real name was d'Arjou Alvers, he was called Ducor d'Arjou because his pork was, without doubt, the best to be had in all the 10 surrounding villages and towns. The secret of his success lay in a discovery that he had kept to himself for several years. By the time the secret began to leak, his reputation was as solid as a fortress. Pregnant women craved his sausages. The corpulent Bishop of Mangalore dined only on his pork chops, and the rich ladies of Mangalore reserved the choicest cuts months in advance of major feasts. Ducor d'Arjou's rise to wealth and fame got its start quite innocently when his wife, Pauline, bought a large pot of toddy to prepare rice dumplings for the pair's feast. She put it in the morning sun in an open clay pot to ferment and ripen and hum with life, producing countless happy bubbles. She was aware that only a fool would close a pot with live toddy and risk an explosion. Ducor d'Arjou had raised a 400-pound pig to be slaughtered for the feast. The lucky pig sauntered into the yard, chanced upon the pot of toddy, drank it to the last drop, and became very intoxicated. By the time Ducor d'Arjou had discovered the loss of the toddy, the pig was lying down in the sun, in an alcoholic haze, with a broad smile plastered to its face. Ducor d'Arjou had to honor his commitment to supply the pig meat to several families in the parish, and was obliged to proceed with the slaughtering without waiting for the pig to sober up. Normally, the pig would have resisted his efforts to tie it down with all its might, and it would have let out deafening shrieks throughout the elaborate killing process. He had even heard of an instance in which a pig was so frightened during the slaughter that it shut down its bladder and redirected its urine to its veins and muscles, imparting a distinct foul odor to every piece of meat. But with a large pot of toddy in its belly, Ducor d'Arjou's pig was submissive as a lamb. When he shaved its neck and cut an incision through its thick hide so that he could dig the knife deep and cut the jugular, the pig did not panic, but actually seemed to start giggling as though it was being tickled. People who bought the meat of the drunken pig unequivocally commended its high quality and said they had never tasted pork so good in their lives. Ducor d'Arjou realized then and there that the secret of the exquisite taste lay in the fact that the pig had died happy, laughing to its last breath. From then on, he fed copious amounts of toddy to his pigs before he slaughtered them, and his fame as the provider of unbelievably tasty pork spread far and wide, bestowing on him wealth and his nickname before he slaughtered them, and his fame as the provider of unbelievably tasty pork spread wide and far, bestowing on him wealth and his nickname. But he rarely ate the meat of any of the animals he slaughtered. In his intimate involvement in their execution and dismemberment, he lost all desire to eat their parts. What he loved most of all was fish, and Chèvetot in particular, with pearls of fat lining its stomach. Ducor d'Arjou proudly presented the regal fish to his wife upon his return from the market, and although ravenously hungry, he decided to postpone his meal until the Chèvetot curry had been prepared. As she cleaned the fish, Pauline noticed that the fat lining its stomach was at least half an inch thick, a sure sign that the Chèvetot had been bursting with energy and good health. She concluded a better fish could not be found. She grated a medium dry coconut and then roasted coriander, cumin, red chilies, and fenugreek to perfection, filling her kitchen with tantalizing aromas. She ground the spices to a smooth consistency and fried the onions golden brown, preparing a curry that brimmed with delicious, delightful flavors. However, as she lifted the clay vessel from the wood-burning stove, something terrible happened. She may have been startled by the cat jumping from the rafters. Maybe she saw a ghost. Perhaps she had a temporary seizure. No one will ever know. But there's no disputing that she shrieked and dropped the vessel, which shattered into 1,000 pieces on the floor, spreading the fish curry into a huge, messy, golden yellow stain. Ducor d'Arjou heard the noise and rushed to the kitchen. He realized what had happened, and with a sudden and uncontrollable rage, induced by greed and hunger, he dealt a mighty blow with his right hand to Pauline's temple. She swirled in a swoon and went down like a felled tree, hitting her head on the grinding stone. Pauline died instantly. Ducor Dorju could do nothing to save her. When he realized what he had done, Ducor Dorju's brain turned mushy, his knees became jelly, and deep inside his bowels, a turd throbbed violently. He trotted to the outhouse and tried to control the convulsions induced by mortal fear. Pauline died at about 2 p.m. Their children, aged 10, 8, and 6, would be home from school by 5. By the time Ducor Dorju cleaned the kitchen, Pauline's body had turned cold. He had no idea what to do. He looked around the house and his eyes settled on the morgue. The oblong tub, used for storing salted pork, resembled a flat-bottomed boat carved out of a huge tree trunk with a matching heavy lid. The empty morgue was 7 feet long and 3 feet deep and had a shell more than 4 inches thick. Ducor Dorju lifted Pauline and placed her body in the morgue, covered the corpse with several bags of salt, and then closed the heavy lid. He loaded several bags of rice on top to ensure that no one would ever think of lifting the lid. Pauline may have remained indefinitely in the morgue, but for the fact that she and her children were supposed to go to her parents' home in Puteaux for their parish feast. When Salvador and Simone and Carmen arrived home from school, Ducor Dorju told the children that their mother had gone to the feast without them to take care of some business, and their presence was not advisable. They did not understand what he meant and were disappointed, but they quietly went about their lives as directed by their father. He had always been exceptionally kind and gentle to them. When she missed the parish feast, for the first time since she had married, Pauline's family panicked and dispatched her brother, Jeremy, and her cousin, Marcel, to Upil early the next morning. They were walking down a hill when they met Tockling Thecla, Pauline's neighbor. She showed some surprise when she saw that Pauline had not returned with them. Jeremy and Marcel told Tockling Thecla that Pauline had not come to the parish feast. Such a thing was impossible, Tockling Thecla informed them. She had heard with her own ears from Ducor Dorju that his wife had left on Monday for her parents' place. She found the entire business confusing, but had no time to ponder it, because she had to see Shivarama Shastri to get medicine for a constipated cow that had stopped eating for 2 days. She hurried away. Ducor Dorju was not at home when Jeremy and Marcel arrived. Doors were never locked in the village, and they pushed the door open and entered the house. They searched the premises and found no sign of life, with the exception of a few flies buzzing around the morgue. Prompted by fear, suspicion, and a dose of intuition, the two men decided to investigate. They removed the bags of rice, and when they lifted the heavy lid from the morgue, Pauline's corpse, bent like a bow after 4 days in the salt, with her head pushed up against the lid, suddenly found relief and sprang upright into a sitting position, terrifying her brother and cousin. Ducor Dorju entered the house just as it dawned on Jeremy and Marcel that the desiccated apparition, with matted hair sticking out in coils and skin shriveled and corroded by the salt, belonged to the once angelic and tender Pauline. A scuffle and fight ensued. The brother and cousin were the first to attack. Ducor Dorju's pig killer's hands grabbed Marcel and threw him against the wall 10 feet away. He then started strangling Jeremy. Marcel revived, grabbed one of the pig slaughtering knives, and stabbed Ducor Dorju repeatedly in the back until he lost his bearings and fell to the floor. He glared at his foes, eyes alert and angry like pools of fire. Marcel, in excruciating pain owing to broken ribs, could not bear the raging fire pouring out of Ducor Dorju's glowering eyes. He stabbed him in both eyes, extinguishing the fire in them once and for all. Despite the multiple stabbings, Ducor Dorju did not die right away. He lay in a puddle of his own blood, gasping for air, and explain what had happened. He told them that his wife's death had been a mistake. He begged his attackers to finish him off and put an end to his misery. Pauline's brother and cousin looked at each other in the eerie silence that followed the confession and lost the determination to fatally stab Ducor d'Orjou and set free his soul. Instead, they dragged him out through the back door and into the woods and tied him to a tree. They returned to the house and put Pauline's body back in the morgue and covered it with a heavy lid. Then they fled back to Patur. When Salvador returned home from school with his sisters, he saw the congealed blood on the floor in the dark hall, but no sign of his father in the house. He went searching in the backyard for him and into the woods and finally found him tied to the tree. Ducor d'Orjou was soaked in blood. Red ants poured out of his eye sockets. Salvador tried to shriek, but found he had no voice. Jeremy and Marcel narrated the events in detail to their families and then went into hiding in the Western Ghat Mountains. Pauline's parents and the rest of the family rushed to Upal. They found Salvador sitting silently in front of the tree and the girls playing at a corner of the house. Pauline's parents took charge and arranged the funerals. Aunt Aggie, a childless, widowed matron, agreed to care for the children. Simone and Carmen grew up to be the highly devout Elvira spinsters. Salvador stopped talking and grew up to become the mute, silent Salvador. Although his aunt, teachers, and parish priest tried to coax words out of him, he refused to speak and forever remained silent. He attended school and church religiously, but remained a silent observer of life, never uttering another word. He was a permanent fixture at the Upal Valley Gumat Players practice sessions and at Ramo Rayo's storytelling gatherings. He listened with rapt attention. He also read anything and everything that came his way. A few years later, he began writing aphorisms on scraps of paper that no one understood. By the time it was discovered that they had contained accurate predictions of future events, it was too late, and people clamored to find the scraps of paper he had written on, or tried in vain to recall what they had read, and, at the time, lightheartedly dismissed as the ink spillings of an imbecile.
That was John Dunford reading Spectral Sword Fight, The Elvira Spinsters, Ducor d'Orjou, and Silent Salvador, an excerpt from The Taste of Water, written by Frankie Diaz. Visit the publications section of the Life Rattle website to read more about this upcoming Life Rattle publication, available in approximately 1 week. And for more information about the upcoming book launch and video release celebration on December 2nd at Supermarket in Toronto, all are welcome to attend. This concludes Life Rattle number 1231. My name is Laurie Callis. John Dunford recorded this excerpt from The Taste of Water, a novel, written by Frankie Diaz. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Achtman. Tune into Life Rattle next Thursday evening to hear more new stories.